This afternoon, we're going to have a presentation entitled Plain Speaking and Straight Shooting, a Documentary Art in Flyover Country by Michael Farrell. Michael will begin making photographs in the late 1960s during his college years in the Fine Arts Department at Indiana University. After earning a master's degree in Chicago at the Institute of Design, he moved to Lincoln in 1972 to work at Nebraska ETV, where he currently holds the position of television production manager, and he's also an adjunct faculty member in the UNL College of Journalism. During the 70s and 80s, Michael created a large body of very personal work in photography, drawing, collage, and assembled objects. The work was first shown at a one-person exhibit at the University Place Art Center in 1991. Following that initial exhibition, he decided to actively pursue other opportunities to show his art in Nebraska and the Midwest. Well, in the last two decades, his work has been seen in exhibitions and is included in collections at the Museum of Nebraska Art, the Joslin Art Museum, and the Great Plains Art Museum. His work has been shown in several regional venues and is included in a number of private collections. He is a recipient of the Nebraska Art Council's Individual Artist Fellowship. Please help me welcome Michael Farrell.
Well, thanks to Jim Steubendick and the staff here at the Center for Great Plains Studies for inviting me to participate in this year's Olson Lecture Series. It's quite an honor to be invited to talk at a seminar named after one of the great educators and thinkers to be associated with this university. It's also an incredible experience to be here with you to discuss the topic of the day surrounded by my own work, work that's occupied a major portion of my free time for the past 6 years. While if we have time, I'll spend a few moments later discussing my work, that's not the primary focus today. I titled my talk, Plain Speaking and Straight Shooting, Documentary Art in Flyover Country. I think of documentary, as we practice it today, primarily as a form of art, a creative effort that assembles images, words, and other evidence to tell stories based in the real and presented in a variety of media venues, and which is more like collage than it is like other well-known art forms like painting or sculpture. So I'd like to take us on a journey back to the days when what was known to the early European Americans about our Central Plains region was still sketchy, and then to travel up the timeline to today to see how the documentary form has developed, and then to suggest what might lie just around the next bend. In the attempt to describe the arc of development of this art form over the past couple of centuries, I think we should meet a number of the artists and see what they attempted and how their work has fared over time. My list of notables is not intended to be complete, but is drawn from my experience in producing documentary films about our region during the past 3.5 decades. Over that time, I've recast the artwork of my forebears, asking it and them to help me tell my stories. I'd like to go way back to the most simple definition of documentary, the desire to record in some way the facts and events that the author deems worthy of preserving. Most cultures practice some form of commemorative art. We mark graves, decorating them and noting who's buried there. We inscribe on stone, wood, or leather in signs and symbols the noteworthy events of the time. I come from a long line of gravestone makers. Both my father and grandfather were monument men. Unlike the ways I've spent my career, the work they did was intended for relatively small audiences, families and close friends of the person being documented. I don't think that they or others like them who record for personal and family reasons think of themselves as documentarians. They were craftsmen. Most documentary artists have a strong need for a mass audience to receive, learn from, and appreciate their work. On the plains, like the desert Southwest, the pictographs and petroglyphs of the tribal peoples who were here in the early years of the 19th century have not survived well. We do have painted winter count hides that tell the stories of the tribe or band's history backwards, one major event per year. For the Lakota, years are measured from first snowfall to the next first snowfall. This pictorial shorthand imagery was designed to help the keeper of the winter count to remember and tell the story associated with that imagery. So in these winter counts, when used by the tribal historian to tell the tribe's story, we have picture and narration, two fundamental elements of the documentary tradition. The tribal warriors also used painted hide shields. This art form was not intended to tell the same kind of story that the Winter Count painting told. Hide shields frequently told of the individual warrior's spiritual encounters and called on the spiritual beings represented in the imagery to help guide and protect the warrior. So I think of these as another form of documentary, that of the highly symbolic image representing the personal and ineffable, but a documentary nonetheless, even though the meanings are probably no longer available. Later, when the tribes were moved onto reservations, many of the artistic and historically inclined got white man art materials and began to record their tribe's noteworthy events in ledger books. These bound volumes had replaceable pages between hard covers that could be added or removed easily. Tribal artists obtained them, as well as colored pencils, crayons, and cheap watercolors from the post traders or government agents. And because there was a movement of younger people back and forth to the boarding schools, styles migrated from one group to another fairly quickly. Today, there are over 200 of these in collections in the US and Europe. Because they are fragile and the colors and materials deteriorate easily, there's a movement to digitize as many of them as possible in order for tribal people and others to be able to see them in good facsimile versions. When the Euro-Americans arrived to take possession of the Louisiana Purchase early in the 19th century, they brought with them a recently developed cultural sensibility jolted into being in part with the discovery of the New World. Imagine what the news of this newly discovered continent and its flora, fauna, and people's very existence did to the minds of Europeans just recovering and emerging out of the Middle Ages and the Black Death. Not only did the riches of this continent help fuel the rise of the middle class in Europe and here in the colonies during the 17th and 18th centuries, but the New World and its peoples presented a fundamental challenge to conventional religious and received knowledge about man's place in the world. Europe was startled to find that some things long held to be basic truths no longer computed. The age of scientific curiosity and the rise of reason and logic over belief and superstition was at hand. Educated Euro-Americans were also marked by a curiosity and a thirst for knowledge about this continent, its peoples, and properties. As the 19th century dawned, we knew very little about this new acquisition. Sent by Thomas Jefferson as his surrogates, Lewis and Clark made maps, kept journals, and brought back natural history specimens with them on their return to the East. It was many years before their journals and maps were published and reached the public. Although one is not inclined to think of them as artists, I think Clark's maps were highly artistic, but then I favor good maps as essential for my own work and appreciate them as creative works given their limitations for expressions. But we have to think of Lewis and Clark's efforts as documentary in the sense that they recorded their experiences in written and visual form, intending to convey to an audience the noteworthy aspects of that experience and to present the facts as they perceive them to a wider public thirsty for knowledge about this region. Following Lewis and Clark, the next wave of explorers to the plains took care to bring along trained visual artists to help record their encounters with the region in pictures. My favorite is Titian Peale, who traveled with Stephen H. Long in 1819 and 1820. The Long expedition traveled first up the Missouri in the steamboat Western Engineer, the first steamboat to make that journey, to make winter camp at Engineer Cantonment near the Council Bluffs, but on the west bank of the river. And then the next spring up the Platte and South Platte to the Front Range of the Rockies. Titian Peale was apprenticed to Thomas Say, the expedition's naturalist, and assigned to make drawings and watercolors of animals, birds, and natural phenomena. Born in 1799, Peale had been raised in the scientific and artistic environment of his father's museum in Philadelphia. Philosophical Hall was Charles Wilson Peale's museum that celebrated not only scientific knowledge, but also artistic endeavors. Here, the elder Peale exhibited things like mastodon fossils alongside paintings such as Gilbert Stuart's portrait of George Washington. Peale's museum was an early attempt to bring the public into the realms of science and art. Long's expedition eventually ran into trouble when he split his forces south of here in the Arkansas watershed. They nearly starved, and most of his notes were lost when members of the expedition deserted and were assumed to have been killed by natives. But Peale's watercolors and sketches made it home with him. There are several hundred examples of his work, including many of his watercolors from the Long Expedition, in the collection of the American Philosophical Society in Philadelphia. Perhaps it was in part Long's bad experiences that led him to characterize the region as a great desert. Titian Peale was a talented artist who later in life ran afoul of another expedition leader, Charles Wilkes, whose trip around the world from 1838 to 1842 was an important first for American science. Wilkes demanded credit for many Peale's discoveries, and their relationship ended with Wilkes barring publication of Peale's 1848 account titled Mammalia and Ornithology. After that, he had a difficult time supporting his family with his artwork or as a naturalist. He took a job as a patent inspector in Washington, D.C., and stayed in that position until he retired in 1875. He never gave up painting or his work with nature. At the end of his life, Peale was enamored of photography and worked extensively with butterflies, even inventing a display case now named for him that allowed the viewer to see both sides of the specimen. He died in 1885. Peale and his contemporaries like Long, Thomas Say, Lewis and Clark, and even his nemesis, Charles Wilkes, were people who wanted to classify and sort through their encounters with this new-to-them region. Their methods were to make lists, note features, create hierarchies, and classifications. George Catlin, born in 1796, was also of this mindset, but with a romantic twist. He first came west in 1830 under William Clark's wing, while Clark was leading a diplomatic mission to the tribes of the Upper Missouri. Catlin had had a checkered career as a painter in the East when he was struck with the idea that the tribal people were disappearing fast and that he should paint portraits of as many examples of the various tribes as he could before it was too late. He developed a method of working in oil paint suited to his self-imposed nomadic lifestyle. He restricted his palette to a few colors that would dry quickly, allowing him to roll up his canvases for easier travel. He indicated dress and accoutrement in a sketchy shorthand that he intended to finish later. He spent most of his field time with his subjects recording a faithful likeness. Catlin made St. Louis his base and made a total of 5 trips between 1830 and 36. He visited and painted about 50 tribes, making approximately 500 paintings during this intense period of creativity. He's credited as being the first Euro-American to gain access to the pipestone quarries in southwestern Minnesota, and the soft red stone was named Catlinite in his honor. I suppose it's also an indication of the blind arrogance of these early explorers that wherever they went, they discovered and named everything without much regard to the names or traditions that already existed. On Catlin's third trip, he stayed with the Mandan near Fort Union on the Upper Missouri. There he painted portraits of tribal leaders and was allowed to make images of some of the Mandan ceremonies. Only a few years after his visit, the Mandan were almost completely wiped out by smallpox. His record of their way of life is considered by many to be his most noteworthy anthropological achievement. But his overarching purpose was to bring back as complete a record of as many tribes as he could and to share them with a wide audience. He eventually created his Indian gallery, which included his paintings and his collection of tribal artifacts. He toured it throughout the East and Europe, giving lectures as well. He also made copies of many of the paintings, selling them as well as graphic art versions. But his success was mixed, and he was not able to generate enough revenue to remain solvent. He decided to try to sell the entire collection to the federal government, and that was met with little success. In 1852, he was forced to auction off the entire gallery of 600 paintings. They were bought by industrialist Joseph Harrison, who stored them away from public view in a warehouse. Catlin spent the final 20 years of his life trying to create replacement copies based on outlines he made of the originals before they were sold. In 1872, the last year of his life, he was invited by the first director of the Smithsonian Institution to live and paint in an upstairs room at the Castle on the Mall in D.C. A few years after his death, Harrison's widow donated the original Indian gallery, more than 500 works, to the Smithsonian, finally realizing Catlin's dream in 1879. 700 of his sketches are at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. Next up is Swiss artist Carl Bodmer, who in 1832 to 34 accompanied German prince Maximilian Neuwied on his expedition up the Missouri. After arriving in North America in 1832 and overwintering in New Harmony, Indiana, the two, accompanied by their huntsmen, traveled upriver with an American Fur Company flotilla bound for the fur trade forts. Like Catlin, Bodmer sought to commemorate the native peoples he and the prince encountered. The prince made detailed field notes about the tribes and their languages and customs, concentrating on the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara around Fort Clark on the Upper Missouri. Having a wealthy and intellectually inclined patron like Maximilian made it possible for Bodmer to achieve wide distribution for his images. Between 1839 and 44, the prince published several editions of Travels in the Interior of North America, 1832 to 1834. It was a distinct publishing achievement, including the prince's extensive notes and 81 of Bodmer's paintings rendered in aquatint, a delicate and expensive method of reproduction. In the various versions issued, the illustrations were also reproduced in black and white and as hand-tinted sets on a variety of papers. It seems that the prince agreed to spare no expense. When the two returned to Europe after their travels in the plains, Bodmer went to Paris to oversee the production of the aquatints. Later, he became a French citizen, living out his days as an artist in Barbizon. Bodmer's original watercolors remained in Maximilian's hands and were archived at his family's estate. After the close of World War II, the collection was purchased and brought to this country, where it became part of the Northern Natural Gas Company collection of Western art that eventually ended up at the Joslin Art Museum in Omaha. Alfred Jacob Miller has a similar story. Born in Baltimore in 1810, he studied with Thomas Sully, a Philadelphia portrait painter, spent a couple of years painting in Paris before returning home to open a portrait studio. In 1837, he's in New Orleans, where he encounters Captain William Drummond Stewart, a Scottish adventurer who had already been in the West several years following fur traders to the various rendezvous on the Green River, Ham's Fork, and Horse Creek. Stewart had come to New Orleans to speculate in the cotton market as a way of raising enough capital to extend his stay and continue his adventures among the mountain men. In New Orleans, Stewart hired Miller to make paintings on his fourth trip west. They joined Thomas Fitzpatrick's train, with Miller making sketches and watercolors along the way. Miller made about 200 watercolors depicting the life of the trapper, trader, and their native counterparts. His record is unique in that regard, and he's considered the first Western-trained artist to paint the Rockies. His work tends to the romantic more than Catlin or Bodmer. After the rendezvous, Miller went back home to Baltimore, where he finished a number of oil versions of his paintings, many of which were destined for Stewart's estate in Scotland. Following a trip to London in 1840, where he encountered Catlin and his Indian gallery on tour, Miller returned to Baltimore and began making copies of his Indian subjects to sell. In 1858, Baltimore industrialist and art collector William T. Walters commissioned Miller to make copies of the complete set of 200 pictures of the rendezvous trip of 1837. Today, they are a significant collection at the Walters Art Museum in Baltimore, which grew out of the Walters Art Gallery. Most of Miller's work remains in private hands, and he remained relatively unknown until almost a half a century had elapsed after his death in 1874. In 1935, a collection of 100 watercolors was discovered in a storeroom at a museum in Baltimore, reigniting interest in his work. Although he's now remembered as a pioneering artist of the West, during his lifetime he wanted to be known as a portrait painter. One assumes that the practical considerations of earning a living drove his self-image. Now, before we leave these early painters and explorers, I'd like to insert a bit about one of the more vexing and intriguing figures of the era, John Charles Fremont. We could spend the entire lecture on him alone, but in terms of his contributions to the documentary form, I'd like to point out a couple of things. In 1841, Congress appropriated $30,000 for a survey of the trails west. Lieutenant Fremont was named the survey's leader. With him were the famous scout Kit Carson and a German-born cartographer, Charles Preuss, born in 1803. Fremont's expedition during the spring and through the fall of 1842 was the first of two that he did that covered the trails west. That winter, he returned to Washington and began to write his report, which was published with maps and illustrations by Preuss. A report on the exploration of the country lying between the Missouri River and the Rocky Mountains on the line of the Kansas and Great Platte Rivers was his first report. Much has been written and speculated about the role that Jesse Benton Fremont, his wife and the daughter of the powerful senator from Missouri, played in authoring the report, but now most believe the language and storytelling style to be Fremont's own. Also noted has been the rancorous relationship between Fremont and Preuss, who thought Fremont to be overbearing and egotistical. For the balance, we know that Preuss was ill much of the journey and probably suffered from depression. Preuss was an excellent map maker. Working with Fremont's astronomical observations, Preuss drew in the details. His maps set the standard for the next couple of decades and were used by many travelers headed west in those years. There has been speculation that Preuss used both the camera lucida and the camera obscura as aids in preparing his field drawings. In the records of Fremont's expenditures for the 1842 trek, there are entries for the purchase of one each of these instruments, which were forerunners to the photographic camera and chemical-based photography that was in its infancy at the time, having recently been invented in France by Daguerre in 1839. In fact, Fremont also bought a daguerreotype camera, but according to Preuss's account, had difficulty with it and returned with no photographic pictures. After his subsequent explorations farther west in 1843 and 44, he published his second report. It was a bestseller for its time, and eventually, because it was a government publication, not copyrighted, was reprinted in a wide variety of commercial editions. Many tens of thousands of copies were printed, and it was one of the most widely read guidebooks and accounts of the West prior to the Gold Rush. Proust was an obscure fellow well into the mid-20th century. Then Proust's diary from the expeditions was discovered in Germany in 1954. He participated in four of Fremont's Western expeditions, but declined to go along on a fifth. He committed suicide in 1854. Fremont was a promoter of Western expansion. Thousands of people were ready to follow his advice and try their hands at the move to Oregon or California. The difference between Fremont and Long was that Fremont saw possibilities and inspired the public. In 1846, with the Bear Flag Rebellion, Fremont helped bring California into the Union. In 1848, he led an ill-fated survey for a possible central route to California for a transcontinental railroad that followed the Platte. In the early 1850s, when then Secretary of War Jefferson Davis commissioned four other possible routes and came out in 1855 favoring a southern route, and in 1856, Fremont was nominated as the first Republican candidate for president. In 1862, Lincoln chose the central route for the Union Pacific. It would be the coming of the railroad that would bring the machine age to the plains and transform it completely. During the period after Fremont's first report was published, many artists also went west, amateurs as well as professionals. Most passed through the Central Plains, and most made images of what they saw here. When the Gold Rush was in full flower in 1849 and 50, one of our artists went west to try to make his fortune in the gold fields near Sacramento. William Miner Quisenberry was from Arkansas. He was a journalist and a reasonable draftsman who, after an unproductive year trying to strike it rich, finally decided to make his way back to Arkansas. He cast his lot with a would-be showman, promoter, and self-styled daguerreotypist, John Wesley Jones. Jones wanted to create an epic panoramic painting that would tell the story of the migration to California and Oregon. This undertaking would be the result of a trip west to east in which Jones would make a photographic record of the notable features along the trail and Quisenberry would sketch them. Later back east in Massachusetts, Jones would hire a team of artists to create a massive painting on rollers that would unwind scene by scene behind a proscenium while Jones delivered a lecture based on his experiences. Jones called his project the Pantoscope. Other similar popular panoramic lecture paintings existed at this time, including a panorama that took viewers on a journey around the tip of South America to the gold fields of California. Another took viewers on a trip down the Mississippi. These panoramic adventures were booked into theaters in the East and generated significant revenues as long as the novelty held. Quisenberry had studied with John Mick Stanley during the latter's Western sojourn in 1842 and 43. He'd then gone west with a contingent of Arkansas gold seekers in 1850. By the end of that year, he'd become a correspondent for the Sacramento Daily Union, and not much later, he joins Jones' party headed east. Later in life, Jones claimed responsibility for creating the first daguerreotype record of the trail. Jones made claims that he'd created more than 2,000 daguerreotypes, but today, no daguerreotypes can be traced to him. We do know that he made good on the promise of touring a panoramic painting based on his and others, including Quisenberry's artwork. It seems that Quisenberry created at least two sketchbooks while employed by Jones, one's here at the State Historical Society thanks to the generosity of the World Herald Foundation. In 1853, Quisenberry founded the Southwest Independent newspaper at Fayetteville, Arkansas. He initially opposed secession, later became a Southern sympathizer. He worked for the removal of some bands of Seminoles from the Florida to Indian Territory in 1859, and he spent some of his years after the war in Texas. In 1875, he fell on hard times and returned to Arkansas where he began to teach art. He drew and wrote poetry and made caricatures throughout his life. He died in Missouri in 1888. So with Jones and Quisenberry, we see an attempt to create in a documentary mode intended for public display, like a play or later like a movie. Jones was following on the footsteps of Catlin in this regard, but his presentation had incidental background music, the scenes unwound in a film-like manner, and there was a very dramatic narration delivered by himself. None of it survives. The form is evolving along literally parallel paths now, with photography trying to make its appearance as the railroad moves west alongside the old trail. And as a side note, Quisenberry's sketchbook will soon be published by the Nebraska State Historical Society, and I've been to many of his locations to photograph the same features, some of which are in this gallery. Now let's talk about John Carbot. Carbot lived from 1832 to 1905. He was a photographer and one of the first to practice the craft in the Central Plains. In 1866, when the Union Pacific Railroad was building west from Omaha, Thomas C. Durant, the controlling vice president, general manager, and master manipulator of the railroad, arranged for the British-born, Chicago-based photographer to accompany a group of dignitaries and railroad officials on an excursion from the Missouri River to the 100th Meridian. Upon laying track to the 100th Meridian, the railroad could now claim the right to push on further west and to continue to earn 6,400 acres of land and $48,000 for each mile built. Durant had a good cause to celebrate. He hired the Pawnee to stage a mock attack on the party. They dined on exquisite food, specially prepared in majestic dining cars. Carbot recorded a number of stereo views of the party and at the end of the tracks. A few years later, after an 1870 fire destroyed his Chicago studio, he left for Philadelphia, where he started the Keystone Dry Plate Works. He was a pioneer in the development of celluloid film, which led directly to the invention of the motion picture camera. This 100th Meridian event was a precursor to the staged buffalo hunt that came a few years later in 1871 with the Grand Duke Alexis of Russia, General Phil Sheridan, George Custer, Buffalo Bill Cody, and a contingent of Sioux under Spotted Tail. So these entertainments with mock Indian attacks and other Western-themed events may have been precursors to the Wild West shows. In this case, the photographs seem to be made initially as souvenirs for the people attending the party. But Carbot publishes them as stereo cards, and the public buys them. What larger messages do these images convey? And that the railroad was in charge, that the Indians were friendly, that the land and its resources were ours to do with as we choose? Next up is a photographer who was hired by the Union Pacific to help create business for the railroad, tourist business. And for much of his life, that's the kind of photography he did. William Henry Jackson, 1843 to 1942, was born in New York, fought in the Civil War, and after he broke off an engagement with a young woman, left for the West. He worked for a short time as a bullwhacker on a freight train headed west to Salt Lake City. Eventually, he came back to Omaha in 1867, where he started a photographic studio. He worked for the UP, making images of Western scenery to help inspire tourist business. He also photographed many of the tribes in Nebraska and documented the last days of the Pawnee in their native homelands. His work on the Hayden Survey in Yellowstone helped to convince Congress to create the National Park System, with Yellowstone as its first in 1872. During this period, just after the Civil War, photography had evolved far from the daguerreotype. That was a process that produced a unique image on a piece of silver-plated copper and which took very long exposures. The new methods included a reproducible image-making process that used a glass negative. Glass plate photography was introduced in 1851 and was still very slow and cumbersome. Jackson and Carbot used what was known as wet plates. For this process to work, the clean glass plate was coated with a mixture of collodion and light-sensitive silver salts. The plate was more sensitive when wet, so the coating was done in a dark tent in the field and the plate exposed in the camera before the mixture could dry. Then it had to be processed on the spot. But the advantage was that once the plate was developed, fixed, and washed, it was permanent, and any number of positive prints on photo paper could be made. Jackson traveled with a stereo wet plate camera that made two images simultaneously side by side, like our eyes see, and another one that took the equivalent of an 8x10-inch negative called a full plate camera, and one that shot mammoth plates, 18 inches by 22 inches. During his time with the Hayden Survey, which covered the better parts of 9 years, he hauled all of this around on pack mules, cameras, lenses, tripods of glass plates, chemicals, dark tents, and so on. It's almost as though the nature of the craftsmanship and the sheer physical effort involved made each one of these images intrinsically more valid or true. Of course, we can only imagine their power to amaze and convince, given that the world had not had access to images in any broadly distributed mass forms until the invention of negative-positive photography. Now, all of a sudden, photographers are swarming the globe, bringing back and distributing evidence of what existed beyond where we might ever be able to go ourselves. It was a rare late 19th century parlor that did not have a stereopticon and a collection of stereo card images from across the globe, just like the stacks of National Geographic magazines that clogged the living rooms of 20th century Americans. Of all the artists we're looking at, William Henry Jackson is one who achieved a high degree of financial stability. Just before the turn of the 20th century, he sold off his collection of 10,000 negatives to the Detroit Publishing Company and joined that firm as a vice president. He worked in the photo and image publishing business until he retired in 1924. He continued to photograph and paint until shortly before he died at the age of 99. But when these pictures were made, not all was settled with the Indian people of the plains. But for many, the end of their old way of living was in sight. These images were among the last of the Pawnee made before they were moved to Oklahoma. Gelatin dry plates, which coated the glass with an emulsion of silver salt suspended in gelatin made from animal hooves, were invented in 1879. George Eastman, the founder of the Kodak Company, marketed these materials. These ready-made plates greatly expanded the amount of shooting a photographer could accomplish because they could be preloaded into light-proof film holders and processed later in a home-based darkroom. And they also made it possible for more and more people to become successful photographers because they were of even quality and consistent in their results. So as the last quarter of the 19th century was beginning, the second act in the drama of the settling of the West was also unfolding, the first being the age of exploration, military expansion, and conquest. Now with the tribes all but subdued and the treaties written, the buffalo all but exterminated, and the Great Transcontinental Railroad and its rivals building new lines throughout the region, settlers were arriving in droves to take up homesteads and build the towns that sprang up along the rail lines. Photographers recorded all of this in great detail. A few are all we'll be able to look at today, but they're among the most interesting. I think we all know Solomon D. Butcher, or at least we should. He was born in Western Virginia in 1856, came with his family to Nebraska in 1880. He tried his hand at farming, but soon realized he should do something else. He tried medical school, but eventually came back to Nebraska and opened a portrait studio in northern Custer County. It had mixed success. In 1886, he decided to document the transformation of Custer County from raw frontier to settled landscape by photographing the pioneer families on their home places. Over the next 26 years, he made over 3,000 glass plate negatives that chronicle the sod house frontier and the growth and challenges faced by the newcomers to the plains. He collected family histories and narratives along with his glass plate images. He hoped to publish a book that would tell the complete story of the transformation of Custer County. But a fire in 1889 destroyed much of the paper research and left him on the brink of financial ruin until a wealthy neighbor provided funding. And in 1901, he published A Pioneer History of Custer County and Short Sketches of the Early Days in Nebraska. In 1911, he tried to sell his collection of negatives to the Nebraska State Historical Society, who realized its value. After 3 years of attempts to persuade the legislature to fund the acquisition, the NSHS was finally successful and was able to provide a few thousand dollars to Butcher in exchange for his life's work. Although his photos are among the most complete record of the transformation of the plains from the open prairie and free range to agricultural and settlement, and are familiar to people across the world, Solomon Butcher died in 1927 thinking he'd been a failure. So let's just look at his work for a minute. Let me have a drink of water and think about what it means for us today to be able to have this work. While Solomon Butcher was documenting the sod house frontier in Nebraska, another photographer was making photographs of the last days of the buffalo and the open range cattle ranches of Montana. L.A. Huffman arrived in Miles City at the age of 25 in 1879. Huffman had studied photography as a young man in Ohio and had worked for a time with Frank J. Haynes, who operated the photo concession at Yellowstone National Park. Shortly after he came to Miles City, he got the position as post photographer at nearby Fort Keogh. The fort had been established in eastern Montana in the aftermath of the Custer fight on the Little Bighorn in 1876. Huffman struck up a friendship with Nelson A. Miles, who was the commander. By 1879, the hostilities with the Indians were ending. The Northern Pacific Railroad was still a couple of years away, and the hide hunters were after the last of the bison herds. Huffman photographed these scenes and others like them in the early years of the 1880s, documenting this grisly aspect of the settling of the plains. They remain his most important work. He also made many photos that document the free-range cattle ranching operations that were soon to disappear as the railroad neared and the newly arriving farmers began to string barbed wire fence. Huffman was a rancher himself, and his admirers say that his photos were accurate and impressive because he knew where to put his camera and when to make his exposures as a result of his personal knowledge. He was elected to the Montana House of Representatives in 1893. He was a passionate conservationist and worked to set aside lands to remain undeveloped as natural preserves. Huffman died in 1931 at the age of 77. Huffman's vintage hand-colored prints now go for about $9,500 to $10,000 in the fine art market. So the plains are being transformed, the buffalo killed off, barbed wire strung, Indians on the res, and the world as it once was is fading fast. Mountain men are colorful anachronisms whose tall tales and stories are becoming the stuff of dime novels. But the Indians aren't completely ready to give up the ghost. In fact, according to the Paiute prophet Wovoka, the time is at hand for a resurrection of the old ways and old people, if we dance what I've seen in my visions. The message races through the boarding schools and thrilling the reservation Indians with the hope that all those killed and starved souls will soon be living among us once again. Well, we all know what happened. Wounded Knee happened. And one of the ways we know is because George Traeger was there with his dry plate camera to record the carnage before the bodies were gathered for mass burial. He was one of several photographers on the scene. Traeger had migrated from his homeland of Germany in 1876 and was in business just off the reservation in Chadron, Nebraska, in the years prior to the Wounded Knee Massacre. His camera was first on the scene, and in the years following, he sold collections of cabinet views, small postcard-sized images from his collection of about a dozen pictures taken of the dead. So let's think about what these images did to our perception of Native peoples when they first came into view. Think back to Catlin, Bodmer, and even Carbot or Jackson. Those Indian images were exotic and strange, and a little bit dangerous. But these people are dead, and violently so. Wounded Knee was a media circus event. Reporters from all over were there filing stories before, during, and after via the telegraph and telephone. And I think these images changed the way that many people thought about the Indians of the Plains, at least people who had a bone of empathy. Another documentarian whose story is very inspiring to me is James Mooney, one of the pioneering ethnologists who worked for the Bureau of American Ethnology recording the languages, cultures, and practices of the native populations of this country in the waning years of the 19th and early years of the 20th centuries. These images of the Arapaho ghost dance were made by him about a year after Wounded Knee. Founded by Congress in 1878 and 79, the Bureau operated under the Smithsonian Institution, then headed by John Wesley Powell, and worked cooperatively with the U.S. Geological Survey, which had grown out of the Hayden Survey of the 60s and 70s, and within the Department of the Interior. While the BAE was supposed to document tribal ways and lifestyles impartially and scientifically, there was a component of do-gooderism within its ranks that promoted assimilation. Alice Fletcher's study of the Omaha and her recommendation to Senator Dawes of Massachusetts led to the Dawes Act of 1889, which broke up tribal lands held in common in favor of individually owned parcels, making it much easier for whites to acquire tribal land from Indians in debt or by tricking the unwary into selling their land for small amounts. Many of the BAE anthropologists thought of photography as an important tool in their work. After George Eastman revolutionized the practice of photography by introducing the Kodak roll film camera in 1889, many photographers saw the advantage of Eastman's slogan, "You push the button, we do the rest." Mooney was an early adopter. The Kodak camera used flexible film instead of glass plates and was loaded with a roll long enough to make 100 negatives. The camera was shipped back to Kodak in Rochester, New York, for the film to be processed. The resulting pictures in a freshly loaded camera came in the return shipment, and the uncropped images were round. So on the southern plains in the winter of 1891, James Mooney photographed Arapaho tribespeople beseeching the spirits to renew the land during one of their ghost dances. His are among the very few images we have of the ghost dance. Recently, a researcher at the BAE Archives in Washington confirmed that there are 78 images that were taken by Mooney, 18 are 5x7 glass plates, and the remaining 60 are these round format Kodak cellulose nitrate negatives. Mooney was not primarily a photographer. Born in 1861, he grew up as the child of Irish immigrants in Richmond, Indiana. He was largely self-taught in his discipline. He became fascinated with Indian people and their languages as a teenager. He compared the plight of the Native Americans to that of the rural Irish.
After teaching school for a short period, he made his way to D.C. in 1885 when Powell hired him for the BAE. Soon he was recognized by his peers as a master anthropologist who published the definitive work on the ghost dance period in 1891. The Ghost Dance Religion and the Sioux Outbreak of 1890, which came out as the 14th annual report of the Bureau of American Ethnology in 1891. Less known are his lifelong study of and interest in the peyote religion, and his work to help the tribal people of the plains form a church based on its use that would be recognized as valid by the government and thereby prevent unwarranted harassment. Today's Native American church owes its existence in part due to his assistance. He died in December 1921 after being confined to a desk job for 2 years as punishment for advocating for the peyote religion. I own a print made from the original negative of this image. The depth of feeling in the photograph is profound and compelling. It portrays a kind of hope and despair that I can't fathom. The 19th century was over for these people, although I've been told that some people still celebrate the ghost dance today. By the early years of the 20th century, large stretches of the plains had been settled. Railroads crisscrossed the prairie, siting towns every 10 or 15 miles along their tracks. It was about that far for a day's wagon ride into town, and the railroads competed to capture the freight business from the grain elevators and the shipping in and out of the town and surrounding communities. That period around 1910 to 1920 was the high water mark for population in many counties on the plains. And many photographers set up shop hoping to make a living with the steady business of weddings, baby pictures, graduations, and family portraits. Occasionally, one of these turned out to be an artist driven to make pictures with more depth and meaning. In Dorrance, Kansas, a young man named L.W. Halby began making photographs of his hometown, its people, and surroundings when he was just 15 years old in 1908. By 1912, he'd developed other interests, left home for law school, and from what has been recorded about him, he never returned to photography. He began his short career when he discovered a Sears and Roebuck box camera in his father's drugstore. He soon taught himself how to use it and to develop and print his own pictures. He charged his clients for the work, 25 cents per picture or $3 for a dozen postcard-sized images. In that span of just 4 years, he made over 1,500 images that beautifully describe small-town life on the Kansas prairie. He lived from 1893 to 1981. Closer to home, up in David City, Nebraska, Harvey Boston was making photographs of that town and its people. He was a basic commercial and portrait photographer, but his collection survived when many similar collections did not. There are stories of hundreds of glass plates being scraped clean of their emulsions and reused as hothouse window panes because the glass was deemed more useful than the old images after the photographer was gone and the business sold. The Boston collection is unusual because the ledger books with the information about the person or place photographed also survived. This means that for the approximately 100,000 ledger entries, about 69,000 negatives have been found, cross-referenced, and identified. Boston bought the business from a previous owner in 1893 and operated it until his death in 1927. After that, his daughter Edith ran the business until 1945. Then her sister Floy and her husband A.C. Hurlbut took it over until into the early 1970s when it was sold and operated for a few more years until finally being auctioned off in 1979. A David City Foundation bought the collection and is actively working to restore and preserve it. With these sorts of collections, we can see the ending of the second big act on the Great Plains. By the time we're not very far into the 20th century, the land is firmly in the hands of the settlers or their descendants. On the Great Plains, it's as though once Wounded Knee is behind us and small-town photographers are using the medium to record the mundane details of everyday life, everything is deemed normal and not so very noteworthy. New immigrant groups are arriving each decade from trouble spots in Europe. Small towns have grown up with telegraph and rail connections, bringing news, messages, and mail order items in just a few days from Sears and other catalog sales companies. From the period just before the building of the railroad to these early 20th century modern times, photography had grown from a highly specialized craft practiced by only a few to a widespread, relatively easy-to-master process practiced by amateurs and professionals alike. During the same period, methods of mechanical reproduction and distribution were invented and improved upon, which made it possible for the masses to see, learn from, and enjoy all sorts of images. And at the same time, traditional art-making practices are going through a radical rethinking and period of creative reaction. Now art runs to the depths of the imagination and forgoes strict representation. Cubism and later surrealism are the results. Both, to my way of thinking, rise in response to the ubiquity of the photograph or its mechanically reproduced double, and in reaction to the advent of the most earth-shaking development in the history of art, the motion picture. And in response to these developments, we get two new visual forms, collage and montage, both of which play an important role in the development of modern documentary forms, and both of which we'll discuss in this next section. So let's step back to just before the turn of the century and switch tracks here to the birth of the motion picture. In 1895, the Lumiere brothers in France developed a portable motion picture camera, the cinematograph. It was a 3-in-1 device that exposed the film and later could be used both to develop and then even to project the results. So now, for the first time, people could see moving pictures of all sorts of events unfolding in time that had been recorded in the places they actually took place with a high degree of photographic reality. These are still frames from the first motion pictures made and exhibited by the Lumières in 1895 and 1896. They don't seem like much to us today, but just think about how profoundly they change the ways we know and understand our world. Now you can go online and see them as movies for free. A few years earlier, Thomas Edison had also created motion pictures, but his had to be photographed in a cumbersome controlled light studio nicknamed the Black Mariah. Both inventions came about in part due to the flexible celluloid-based film cut into strips with sprocket holes that was now being marketed by the Eastman Kodak Company. In fact, by the early 20th century, motion picture film was the top revenue generator for the Eastman Kodak Company. One of the first showmen to realize the potential of the new motion picture was Buffalo Bill Cody. He took several performers from the Wild West show, including tribes people from the Lakota reservations, to Edison's New Jersey studio in 1894. There he recorded versions of Plain Indians dances and Annie Oakley doing trick shooting. But within a decade after the camera became truly portable, Cody had formed his own motion picture company. In 1914, he made a reenacted film of famous Indian battles, including Wounded Knee. He convinced Lieutenant General Nelson A. Miles and troops from the 12th U.S. Cavalry to participate, along with 1,000 Lakota people. The four battles were reenacted in their actual original locations. But these early attempts were crude when it came to having a recognizable plot, varying camera angles, a storyline, and what we'd recognize today as editing. Cody died in 1917. Documentary films or films of any kind made on the plains were not a growth industry. When these films are being shown, we're not very far into the 20th century. Films made on the plains are few and far between for the next 50 years. But from the early days of film history, only one really stands out: The Plow That Broke the Plains, made in 1936 by Per Lorentz, director, writer, editor. Cinematography by Leo Hurwitz, Ralph Steiner, Paul Strand, and Paul Avano, with a score by Virgil Thompson. This film was commissioned by the Resettlement Administration in the early days of the New Deal to promote soil conservation practices and to help audiences understand the consequences of poor land use and agriculture in the preceding decades. Its distribution and the controversy over how Lorentz portrayed the causes of the Dust Bowl helped lead to the adoption of the conservation methods proposed in the Soil Conservation Act of 1935. The film was supposed to have been made for $6,000, but Lorentz was obsessive, kept changing his mind, and had never made a film previously. The cost ballooned to about $20,000. Nevertheless, it was one of the most successful films of its kind, and there is still debate about whether it was a piece of government propaganda or not. It was seen by about 10 million people in 1937 alone, making it one of the most widely viewed documentaries of the pre-television age. One of the reasons it was so successful is that it is well shot and edited. Each frame is a masterpiece of composition and storytelling. It has a spoken narration script that is poetic and lyrical, and it integrates its musical score with the pictures and words rather than the music being an afterthought or as just background for the pictures. Montage is the name we use to describe the editing style of much of The Plow That Broke the Plains. It assumes that the viewer will be able to understand that the content of any individual image is enhanced by its juxtaposition and serial placement with the other images in a sequence. So rather than telling a story that simply unfolds as action in time, in montage, the images are orchestrated for movement, flow from one shot to the next, relative time on the screen, and a kind of musical rhythm and power. These two kinds of editing, montage and continuity or storytelling editing, are two of the most powerful additions to our visual language that came about as the result of the invention of the motion picture. And both are based on how the mind perceives and orders images when we dream. The other powerful addition to the visual language that was developed about the same time is collage. First practiced by Picasso and Georges Braque as part of the Cubist Revolution, collage, like its cousin montage, relies on the juxtaposition of disparate elements within the picture plane to create a visual order that exists out of the normally spatially ordered representation of 3D space and time. To my mind, Cubism and the original version of collage was a reaction to things as mundane as the introduction of photographic or illustrative imagery into newspapers and periodicals, as well as the profound visual shock that artists would have experienced when they saw images projected onto a screen that moved, and then, as editing is introduced, those images not only move, but they jolt the viewer instantaneously from one perspective to another, and they jump around in time. We take all this for granted today and are like fish swimming in this visual language ocean. But these were powerful visual discoveries that gave artists wishing to use imagery based in reality in order to educate, convince, and argue a place to stand and a set of powerful levers. Go online and screen The Plow That Broke the Plains for yourselves, and you'll see what I mean. At the same time, publishing was responding to formal artistic movements like Cubism and Structuralism. The picture and text magazine, poster art, and other forms of graphic communication were engaged in a dialogue with fine artists struggling to develop new visual forms. A couple of additional points about The Plow That Broke the Plains, and each of these were or still are controversial. It was the first time that the government had produced a film that was intended for mass audiences in commercial venues. It introduced several themes that are with us today: the unintended environmental consequences of altering vast stretches of the landscape, the outmigration of rural population from the plains, and the role of the government in stepping in to address these issues. When The Plow That Broke the Plains was in production in 1934, and as it finally premiered in 1936, the Great Plains was already well into the third act of our drama. Economic depression hit the plains shortly after the end of World War II, when Europe geared back up on its own agricultural production. Then the drought and the Dust Bowl hit just after the stock market crashed. The result was a steady decline in farming populations, increased mechanization, loss of small-town viability, the flight of rural youth to the cities, and although there have been periods of rebound, the 2000 U.S. Census counts 0.6% of the population today as listing their occupations as farmers. The high point for farms in the U.S. was in 1935, when there were 6.8 million farms. The Resettlement Administration that commissioned The Plow That Broke the Plains was trying to get farmers in marginal areas of the region, like Sioux County, Nebraska, to move off the land. So for much of the 20th century, the big picture themes for documentary artists working on the Great Plains have been based on these challenges. About the same time that Lorentz was on the plains filming, the Federal Farm Security Administration's Information Division, under the direction of Roy Stryker, sent out a brigade of photographers to document the social, environmental, and human dramas that were unfolding on the plains and elsewhere. Walker Evans, Dorothea Lange, Gordon Parks, Arthur Rothstein, Marion Post Wolcott, and others worked at various times between 1935 and 1944. All of the surviving images from the SFA have been placed online by the Library of Congress, a total of 164,000 negatives. These photographers and many of their best images are so well known that I'm going to gloss over them in favor of one artist who was not of their ranks, but who was influenced by them and yet took their work one step further. Wright Morris, born 1910, died in 1998. He was born in Central City, Nebraska. His dad worked for the Union Pacific. When he was a few days old, his mother died and he was raised for a time by a nanny until his father remarried. He spent a few summers near Norfolk on a farm his Uncle Harry and Aunt Clara ran. As a young man, he traveled in Europe, became interested in fiction, and then returned to the U.S. shortly before the war began. He published his first novel in 1941. Working with money from the first of two Guggenheim Fellowships, in 1942 he began to create a new genre of fiction that he called the phototext, combining his skills as a writer with his talent for photography. The Inhabitants was based on a cross-country road trip he took with his camera. It was published in 1946. At the same time, he started working on The Home Place, which was a description of Uncle Harry's farm in words and pictures. He published it in 1947. But his photo texts didn't sell well, and his publisher didn't want to pursue them. He only made one other photo text, God's Country and My People, which was published in 1968. He was obviously influenced by the picture magazines that burst onto the scene as offset printing made photography accessible to mass audiences. Those magazines combined reportage with powerful documentary photography. Here's a quote from Wright Morris that could apply to a number of other Plains authors whose work has a strong vein of the documentary in it. "I'm not a regional writer, but the characteristics of this region have conditioned what I see, what I look for, and what I find in the world to write about." Perhaps it's the influence of the stark and plain-spoken landscape, but it's noteworthy that several of the most respected writers from the Plains make use of a documentary approach, ranging from a very loose interpretation of fact to almost direct reportage. Willa Cather, John Neihardt, and Mary Sandoz each has works that document some aspect of their or their subject's experience on the Plains. And while we're at it, we should also note a couple of those who tried to document through the art of the interview. A retired judge from Chadron, Eli S. Riker, 1842 to 1926, developed a passion for and recorded the stories of many of the Native and white participants in the Indian Wars. He hoped to write a book that he'd titled The Final Conflict Between the Red Man and the Palefaces, but it was never finished. In 1905, he began interviewing people still alive who had experienced the transformation of the Great Plains, including settlers, military veterans, trappers, and about 50 Native Americans. He spent the last decades of his life gathering more and more material that he could never seem to wrestle into a coherent narrative. But today, his interviews, written in pencil on little notebooks, are at the State Historical Society, and they provide unique firsthand accounts quoted by many contemporary authors and researchers. Another interviewer is Eleanor Hinman. In the summer of 1930, Eleanor Hinman interviewed a number of the Lakota participants in the Plains Indian Wars about the life of Crazy Horse, including one of his closest allies, He Dog. She'd been researching and doing background work for a book she hoped to write about Crazy Horse's life when she became acquainted with Mary Sandoz. She decided to turn her material over to Sandoz and then go with her on a trip to the reservations to interview the Lakota still alive who had known Crazy Horse. Their work that summer and the notes that Hinman gave to Sandoz formed the basis for Crazy Horse, The Strange Man of the Ogallalas, Sandoz's second most successful book after Old Jules. By the early 1950s, there were still very few motion picture documentaries about Great Plains subjects. Then in 1954, the University of Nebraska obtained a license for Channel 12, and the beginning of NET television was underway. Ron Hall was one of the first employees after Jack McBride. Soon he was producing educational programs in partnership with the Nebraska State Historical Society, then under Marvin Kivett. One of those early programs, A Land of Their Own, made use of Solomon Butcher's sodhouse photographs and the letters of a Custer County settler named Uriah Oblinger, provided firsthand reality to the script. In the crude studio-based style of the day, a script was recorded and the photos scored to the text. Then the pictures were divided into even and odd-numbered piles and put on copy stands with two TV cameras each sending picture through a switcher. As the narration track was played back, the director took camera one, then camera two, occasionally dissolving between images. As the story progressed, the photos were flipped down and the next one revealed. This type of production soon became known as a flip-stand epic, and it predated the signature Ken Burns style by three decades. Ron Hall was the force behind the remarkable achievements in the documentary form that were produced by the staff of NET during the period from the late 60s through the last decade of the 20th century. If you look at what neighboring states have accomplished in creating documentary-based television to tell their stories or the stories of a particular state or the Great Plains region, there really are no comparisons. NET's commitment to the documentary under Ron's guidance in matters of content was remarkable. Working with talented department managers, he assembled a staff of producers who have delivered hundreds of hours of documentary content, which grew particularly after the statewide network was formed in the late 60s, with new annual state appropriations providing necessary seed funding for these local productions. Long-term partnerships with the State Arts and Humanities Council, occasional federal humanities or science funding, as well as continued cooperation with the State Historical Society have resulted in dozens of programs that explore the history and culture of the state and region, many of which have been distributed regionally, nationally, and even occasionally internationally. Our audiences for these productions have been enormous. Each of these programs has been seen by hundreds of thousands of people. I'll just use one example that I know about because I produced the show. In Search of the Oregon Trail was a two-part, three-hour show that aired nationally on PBS in April 1997. It was ranked in the top 10 of PBS specials that year. It did well in the ratings. It reached somewhere in the neighborhood of 7 to 9 million people the night it was originally broadcast. It aired three more times after that on PBS, and we distributed it for two more national releases in the next few years. So all told, it has been seen by tens of millions of people. Many of our other shows since then have done as well. A core group of NET producers has created the majority of this content. Now many of us are either in our 60s or fast approaching them. NET has had a very stable workforce, particularly among the creative staff. To be sure, there are many creative people outside NET who are also producing important work in the documentary field. Joel Sartori, Mike Forsberg, Bill Gansel, Don Dahl, Roger Brune, and Larry Ferguson come to mind locally. And then there's a group that I call the drop-in documentarians, David Sutherland's Farmer's Wife, Rick Burns' The West, and Ken Burns' Lewis and Clark, are nationally respected filmmakers who have been here recently. Now, as we wind up, I'd just like to show several frames that list the documentary accomplishments of my colleagues at NET. Many of this group are also long in the tooth. Many of us soon will retire, although I suppose that now most will not be retiring very soon compared to what we may have thought 2 weeks ago. Now we all face certain challenges and opportunities as we penetrate the first decades of the 21st century. So it's time to think about the future for the documentary here in Nebraska and on the Great Plains. I think there are several things to consider. Number one, how to conserve and protect the material that is the result of all this effort. In our previous examples, either private, institutional, or government patronage was essential to the work being created and preserved. And that's certainly still true today. Our culture does not support the individual artist very often. But after he or she has died, we value the work and are appreciative that it is there for us or for future generations. TV executives don't always see the archival value in the material beyond the finished program. The outtakes may have more value in the future than the edited product. But then there's the question of volume, and now in the digital world, questions of changing formats and obsolete software. These challenges are facing everyone and every institution worldwide working in a creative form that originates or preserves as digital files. We won't solve the problem ourselves, but we have to think and plan for how to determine what will be saved and how to pay for it. Secondly, how will we pass on to the next generation the skills that we've developed over the past half century? And how will we identify new talent and provide opportunities for them to develop their skills so that at least some of them will stay here? 2 years ago, with support from Barbara Couture, the Senior Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs, NET started an internship program in partnership with the College of Journalism and Fine and Performing Arts. We're passing on bits and pieces of our skills and knowledge in short bursts, with about 10 paid student interns each working 10 hours weekly. So that's a start. And now the program has been provided partial funding for the next 3 years, so it has an opportunity to become self-sustaining. But I see a huge potential for cross-departmental effort or even a graduate degree-based discipline to be developed within those two departments and perhaps shared by several additional departments to study and create at a high level of competence in nonfiction forms, both traditional and new media. I also now teach a class in documentary each semester that draws about 7 to 10 students eager to learn about the art of nonfiction storytelling over and above the technical and craft approach that their basic production courses offer. With the rise of cable and now with most media outlets moving to web delivery that includes full motion video streaming, there are jobs for young people in producing long and short form documentaries. Equipment costs are such that several of my current students have camera and laptop editing systems that they bought for less than $10,000 that are of higher quality and rival what we were able to afford at NET just a few years ago. I believe that we're entering an era of great possibility and creativity in this form. And the third issue, finally, how will we evolve a storytelling language and grammar, as well as the technology of the documentary, in response to these new media platforms that will drive the delivery of content and thereby dictate some elements of form well into this century? Again, documentary is a collage of research, writing, shooting, editing, music, narration, acquired imagery, and graphics. And now with streaming video deliverable on laptops and handheld devices, the marriage of motion pictures, still photography, graphics, text, interviews, and audio files means that the collage-like nature of this medium will evolve in new ways with new language and storytelling conventions to be announced. Just look at the online version of the New York Times, for example. I truly believe that the future of nonfiction media will be more dramatic, less expensive, and much more compelling than it has been in the past. But the language, grammar, and storytelling conventions of this medium are still in the formative stages. How they will develop is an exciting possibility to ponder and to be able to shape. If we can attract and retain talented undergraduate and graduate students in the coming decade, they will be the ones who provide the creativity to help this form and language evolve on the Great Plains. We should be in the mix, helping to tell our own local and regional stories, and developing these new forms rather than waiting for others to identify and define our issues for us, which would tend to happen in any case. One of the founders of the graduate program I attended in Chicago at the Institute of Design, Laszlo Moholy-Nagy, a Hungarian-born refugee from Hitler's Germany, and one of the founders of the original Bauhaus, famously said in 1932, "The illiterate of the future will be ignorant of the pen and the camera alike." He was right, but limited in his scope. Compelling subject matter will be unfolding around us as the region enters the fourth act in our drama. We should be there with cameras and recorders to tell the stories of how the people and the environment of the plains respond to climate change, what the rise of extractive alternative energy-based agriculture will mean for the future of the region, to chronicle the battle that is sure to be fought over our enormous coal reserves and the carbon emissions they contain. Who will control our surface and groundwater and what it will be used for, the continued aging of our population in the rural areas and how to care for them, the outmigration of our youth, and the continuing battles over endangered species and other environmental issues, and so on. The future themes on the Great Plains will continue to build on what has come before. Like Willa Cather said in O Pioneers, "There are only two or three human stories, and they go on repeating themselves as fiercely as if they'd never happened before, like the larks in this country that have been singing the same five notes over for thousands of years." So what role should the university play in answering these questions? Well, I think a big one, but it will be a stretch for our university to begin to realize that we are in the midst of a revolution in the ways that people receive and transmit information that is as profound as the invention of movable type was. So I'd like to close with a quote from one of the great American photographers, Walker Evans, who wrote in 1938, "Stare. It's the way to educate your eye and more. Stare, pry, listen, eavesdrop. Die knowing something. You're not here long." Thank you.